I'm Christopher Lydon with the singer Linda Ronstadt in a movie theater full of boomers outside Boston. She is the crossover queen who grew up with Mexican street bands and Italian opera in her family. She sold 100 million records over a career across the spectrum of folk and country rock. She sang Mimi in Puccini's La Bohème and Gilbert and Sullivan on Broadway. Then she recorded classics of Tin Pan Alley with Nelson Riddle and duets with Frank Sinatra. So she's done it all. In her musical memoir called Simple Dreams, she stakes the claim that the 57 varieties of popular song in our country are America's greatest gift to the world in our time. So I asked her, could we just talk about those songs and their singers? And maybe by the end of an hour, we'd have a Letterman list of the top 10 pop songs, love songs, art songs that we could send to Mars and brag about. Linda Ronstadt turns out to be easygoing and talkative, as well as encyclopedic and funny. She said, let's go.
Let's just plunge, Linda. What fascinates me is precisely this permeable but so different tradition of songs. There's a moment early in the book where you speak of the influences of writers on writers, singers on singers, etc., and it's everywhere. You say, when you listen to a singer's performance, I often try to track who it was that influenced him or her. For instance, I can hear Nat King Cole in early Ray Charles. I can hear Lefty Frizzell in early Merle Haggard, Rosa Ponselle in Maria Callas, Fats Domino in Randy Newman. In a recent duet with Tony Bennett, the late Amy Winehouse was channeling Dinah Washington and Billie Holiday to great effect, yet she still sounded like Amy Winehouse. So, expand on that. We have sort of 6 degrees or 26 degrees of separation between every kind of song. How does it work?
Well, I think all artists start by copying, and I think anybody that says they don't, they're fibbing a little bit.
And the great ones steal, right?
And the great ones steal, and you have to steal from the best. And you often wind up sounding like a complete original. A person like Joni Mitchell, who doesn't sound like anybody I ever heard, I think copied Joan Baez an awful lot at the beginning. Because I've heard recordings of her and I've heard stuff that she did, and she was doing it as hard as she could. I was trying to copy Joan Baez. We all were doing that in the 60s. But I sang a song called The Waiting that was written by a guy, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. They're my favorite rock and roll band. And in it, when I learned the song, the accent, the regional accent that you have really affects the phrasing because, you know, like down in the South, they'll make two syllables out of one, and then that, and you have to take that into consideration in the rhythm. So he's singing The Waiting. I was listening to him, I was learning this song, and it occurred to me that Tom, you know, was often, he copies a lot of different people because he came along pretty far upstream in the rock and roll world. So he got to copy a lot of different people. And here was Tom Petty copying Roger McGuinn, you know, who was copying Bob Dylan, who was copying Woody Guthrie, who was copying somebody lost to our generation. So, and all the way through, you can hear those little tiny bits of all those people twinkling like facets of a jewel in that line, you know? Or he'll be copying Mick Jagger, who's copying, an American blues man who's copying some guy that he loved, his old grandpa or whoever it was.
They all copy Chuck Berry.
But it all winds up in, you know, there are little bits of each of those regional accents in the final pronunciation of the word, and it affects the rhythm, and it affects the phrasing, and it really affects the vocal tonality.
You sang in Bohème, as everybody knows, but your exposure to opera
began... Not very well.
your exposure to opera began sort of in diapers.
Speak about that. Well, my grandparents had... what they called the Victrola in those days. And we used to go over there, you know, there was always music at our house growing up. Everybody played and sang. My sister loved Hank Williams. My brother was a boy soprano. He was the featured soloist in the Tucson, Arizona Boys Choir, which was then a world-class boys choir. And my dad, you know, played and sang Mexican love songs and American standard songs. He sounded like a cross between Pedro Infante and Frank Sinatra. And when we got tired of listening to our house, we'd sort of trudge over to my grandmother's house, and it would be a completely steady diet of classical music there because my grandfather was a rancher, and he owned a big hardware store in Tucson. But he also was the band leader in the late 1800s. He was the band leader in Tucson. And he taught everybody how to play their instruments, and he made the arrangements for the band. And if you wanted somebody for a serenade, you had to go talk to my grandfather and make arrangements. Or if you wanted something for a military parade, they could supply you with that. Or they could, you know, just for a party, a pachanga, or a baptism, or a wedding, that they were available for that. It was a kind of an oompah band with, you know, woodwinds and horns. So, but my grandfather loved classical music so much, and his favorite opera was La Traviata. So if we went over there, everybody, the aunts and uncles and my grandfather and my grandmother, they had that sheet music on their piano, you know. There would be something from Traviata, there'd be something from Boheme, and somebody would be trying to play it and sing it. And then on Saturday, there was the Metropolitan Opera broadcast, which was always playing on Saturday. My grandmother always listened to it. I'd go and sit with her. And she had all the newest Maria Callas recordings, you know, playing. So I just heard it. It was like family music. That's why when somebody offered me the chance to sing Mimi, the role of Mimi in La Boheme, I went, well, I got a high voice. I can sing that. You know, it's family music. You're right. So
in the book, and let me just say, it's a wonderful book. It feels as if you lived it and you wrote it.
I did.
But the thread, the thread is this slow discovery, this evolution, this endless work, listening, but working on finding your own, not only your own sound, but your own songs, your own place, your own self in your music. But speak a little bit about when your first experiments at hybridizing, you know, Mexican music and La Traviata into something Linda.
It happened when I was recording. I'd be singing away, and I'd think for all the world I sounded exactly like La Tran, and I'd hear the playback, and I sounded just like me, you know, which to me sounds kind of like a little duck on acid. I sound kind of quacky sometimes, especially when I speak. And the worst thing is when I speak, because I talk really fast and kind of hysterical, and then I'm singing, la, 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 and all of a sudden, it's like there's a couple of different people in there, you know. It kind of makes me nervous to hear a playback. But I learned that no matter how hard I tried to copy other people, I wound up sounding like a version of myself, you know, with that, a layer of whatever that was kind of, you know, added in there. Sometimes it was a bad influence. Sometimes I can listen to early recordings and go, oh, I sound like a goat, you know, why did I have all that vibrato? Not like I've been eating billy goat meat, you know. You know.
Yeah. But there comes a point, you know, when you're a star and you're celebrated and you can do anything with anybody, that you realize that it's all kind of a pursuit of, you know, young people don't admit this kind of thing, but you're looking for art songs, and you're making art songs. You're creating something, not all of it, you know, Schubert or Brahms songs, but Lieder. You're looking for American masterpieces. When did you admit that to yourself, and then when did you think, wait, that might be one?
I thought about that in the late 70s, I thought that what we were doing was chasing art song. I had loved John Jacob Niles at the end of the folky movement, and thought that he was sort of considered as the last of the American art song composers. And I thought, no, he wasn't. I mean, Paul Simon is, you know, an art song composer. Leonard Cohen is an exquisite art song composer. Of course, Rodgers and Hart and the Gershwins are art song composers. Mm. They're very, very refined sensibilities, and they're layered in with elements of traditional music and classical music all the way through.
Right.
And I think that those guys are, you know, I always say the best contribution that the United States of America made to the world at large in the 20th century was the popular song.
Amen.
And I think the best of the popular songs of the 20th century are the songs from the American Standard Songbook. They were brilliant, well-crafted, exquisite songs that work on every level of sensibility, like Bette Midler's Thighs and Whispers, you know. It works on a gross level, and if you're a Bergman fan, you get an extra layer of the joke, you know. And those standards are that way too. You can take it as a heartbroken lover, or you can say, with love to lead the way, I can sing, I have more clouds of gray than any Russian play could. Right. So if you read, you know, whatever, if you're Russian,
yeah.
Russian plays, it's better if you have read a Russian play, if you want to sing it. But the listener can hear it on any level.
The Man I Love. Maybe Tuesday will be my good news day.
Yeah.
But, you know, you mentioned two names that I just want to pursue. The Gershwin brothers and also Leonard Cohen. Ira Gershwin, who lived long after George, but he was quoted saying, we didn't know how good our songs were until I heard Ella Fitzgerald sing them.
Yes, or Rosemary Clooney. the best friend a song ever had.
I just love that idea, and we're going to come back to it, of these songs as art songs. We grew up on them as love songs or pop songs, but when you listen to Sinatra singing almost any of those Nelson Riddle songs from the 50s, Here's That Rainy Day, music
That's it,
by
Houston.
Jimmy Van Heusen, lyrics by Johnny Burke, I'm sure. But the other name I just wanted to pick up on was Leonard Cohen. Who would have thought that Canada would produce so many great, should we say, American songs?
Gordon Lightfoot and Joni Mitchell and...
And the sisters, your friends?
The McGarrigle sisters, yeah. And Neil Young. I mean, there's some in the water up there, those Canadians. We're so ethnocentric here. We think that the Canadians are just like us, that they kind of look like us. But I'm a great believer that Canadians are more invested in quality and we're more invested in glamour. And we look at them as kind of stodgy, you know? I love the Canadians. They're so different from us. They're fabulous.
No, they're here to supply our hockey players, basically, I think.
Well, you know, a lot of people walking around without any teeth, but I love those guys.
But explain that, and what is the connection? What is the Canadian touch in a song?
It's just that kind of unbridled heart, you know, that like the McGarrigle sisters didn't have any fear of the editors of Rolling Stone, you know, declaiming them as not hip. I mean, at some point it was like everything had to be funky, and the Rolling Stones defined what was hip and popular music, and if you couldn't be heavy and really hard rock, you know, you just weren't hip enough. Well, what are you going to do with somebody like Paul Simon? What are you going to do with Randy Newman? What are you going to do with Kate and Anna McGarrigle singing, you couldn't call it heart, so you had to call it, so you couldn't call it soul, so you had to call it heart, you know? I mean, they wrote art songs, and they didn't, they just, it was unbridled female sentiment with absolutely no fear of people thinking you're corny. Jimmy Webb does that too. He just goes for it, you know? He doesn't care if anybody thinks he's corny. He's just going to tell. Nothing's going to get in the way of him telling his story as accurately as he can.
Let me just say momentarily, you know, every story is different, and we all have our individual experiences of learning to love songs. And there may be people here old enough to have listened to Bill Marlowe on the radio when we were kids. He had a fantastic music show. He used to call it MUSIC, not NOISE. This was, you know, late 50s, I'd say. And every night at 10 o'clock, we'd be most of the way through our homework, and he would begin his show with Duke Ellington's Hawk Talks, written by Louis Belson, and then the Basie Band and Joe Williams singing All Right, OK, You Win, and then, for the future, Chuck Berry's first huge hit, Maybelline. I mean, that was our baptism, and those are the songs we loved in high school and forever after. And it totally formed my taste, probably more closer to your friend Pete Hamill's taste than your taste, perhaps. But it made it for a lifetime. I'm attached to the notion, sometimes embarrassed by it, that the songs we love at 15 and 16 will become the songs of our whole life.
I don't know that that's the case. I mean,
well, I wonder.
The songs that I heard when I was between 1 and 5 became more the songs of my whole life. Like, I listen more to flamenco music now and Mexican music than I listen to almost anything else. And there's such a vast difference between Spanish music and Mexican music. So I never chased Spanish music as a singer. But when I was a little girl, my father had a record album of a woman called Pastora Pavón, La Niña de los Peines. And she was the finest flamenco singer of the century in Spain. She had her heyday in the 20s, the 1920s. And I loved her singing. And my father had this album with these 78 records, you know, I played them so much, just as a little child, my little baby hands, putting it on the spindle. And I scratched a lot of them. So they went off in the, you know, in storage someplace. And I didn't hear them from the time I was about 6, maybe, until now. And I was writing about it in my book, because she killed me, you know. She sang about something that was so essential, what she was singing about, just a kind of an essential pain and difficulty that she was struggling with. So I found her on YouTube, and to hear that voice again after all those years, I mean, I'm 67, so I guess it would be 62 years that I hadn't heard her voice. And it pinned me to the wall in exactly the same way. So what is that quality that made me able to respond to her in that way as a little child and as a grown-up experienced singer? I don't know what it is. But while I was doing that, I discovered a woman named Estrella Morente, who was a huge star in Spain, and she's also a flamenco singer, very, very highly skilled in the deepest traditions of flamenco singing, and she just kills me. She's the new Pastora Pavón. Check her out on YouTube. She's also very beautiful, by the way.
Isn't YouTube a gift?
I love it. I hate MP3. I don't like iTunes. I hate Pandora. I hate all that stuff. But here's YouTube with really shitty sound and really shitty picture, and I just love it. I go, that's for me, you know? I mean, I love to listen in hi-fi sound, and it breaks my heart that all these years since they invented sound and recording, that every year it got better and better and better until the computer, the internet came along, and now we're putting music out in this way that's just totally diminished. It's not, as a recording artist, I hear something in MP3 and I go, that's not what we put, that's not what we recorded. That's not how we cast the sound. It's a huge soundscape that you're tinkering with, and you want to get that picture exactly right, and somebody comes along and it just screws with your, But YouTube suits me down to the ground. I just love it.
Sometimes the sound is very good. My favorite might be a recording of the Count Basie Band in Sweden, 1962, 4 weeks before I graduated from college. It was shot by an Ingmar Bergman film crew.
Oh, I want to see that.
Great sound people, and it is the Basie Band, Sonny Payne on drums. An incredible.
Okay, you got to send me a link. I'll give you my email.
I will. You send me some suggestions back. I'll listen.
Okay, I'll send you Estrella Morente. She's a dish.
That's a deal. There's a singer on that show, the Basie show in Stockholm, Irene Reed, as Basie introduces her beautifully. She's a fantastic singer. She sings Alexander's great, ragtime band.
Oh, yeah?
She sings Bessie Smith blues, and just incredible. But anyway, I've heard you say, or it's in the book, that you had the fundamental foundations down when you were 10 years old.
Well, for listening, because 99% of singing is listening, is hearing.
Right.
But that other 1% is a booger,
Exactly. But my thought was really, I mean, you're a professional, you've lived every day in this life, and you've learned something every day. I want to know who were the ones that just spun you around and said, wait a second, I didn't know that, including Emmy Lou Harris, including Sinatra, I suppose, but all sorts of people, Joni Mitchell maybe. And then there are special ones. You write very touchingly about Smokey Robinson as a kind of like, wow.
Oh, he is a killer. Now there's a, that guy comes right out of the tradition of, like Aaron Neville, of French Baroque opera singing. Because the French, because in the 18th century, down in New Orleans, there was this Creole community of mixed race people that had, their own slaves and their own place in the economic pie. They were often fantastically wealthy, and they sent their children off to Europe to be educated. And they came back as trained opera singers, trained or orchestra members, orchestra leaders. And so New Orleans had this tremendous tradition of European orchestral and vocal music. And French Baroque opera composer like Lully, French Baroque opera singing, the singing traditions of the 18th century, each region would have its own kind of licks, like, Aretha Franklin has different kind of licks from Smokey Robinson. They have their own, each has their own region of licks. Well, what happened was that New Orleans was Catholic, and so it was French, and when they came back, it's hard to set the stage for this, but 18th century opera singing, when the tenors went really high, instead of going, whoa, like Caruso, they'd go into the falsetto like Smokey Robinson does, and they'd have a lot of these very, very elaborate embellishments. So French Baroque opera became the foundation for the Catholic Creole New Orleans kind of music, which became doo-wop, which became that kind of rock and roll. If you move it over a little bit to Alabama, that's Protestant, and those people sing on the backbeat, and they're belters, and they're great. But it's not like the Catholic Creole traditions of New Orleans. So that's what Smokey Robinson comes out of. That's what Aaron Neville comes out of. So when they're up singing like countertenors, way higher in their register. I got to sing with Smokey Robinson. I almost fell over dead. First, I mean, the guy is so charming. He's the sexiest thing you ever saw. He's got these green eyes, and he knows it too. I met him when I was pretty young playing grad night at Disneyland. And he got into a, my band then was the Eagles, and he got into a poker game with them, and I was prissing around the room, you know, hoping that he would notice me, and he didn't pay any attention to me. So I went home and I learned a whole bunch of his songs. It was the only thing I could do to console myself. And years later, I had a hit with one of his songs. So he invited me to sing on the Motown 20th anniversary show. And all of a sudden, and I'm standing there singing, looking right into these green eyes, and I'm going, oh my God, I'm singing Ooh Baby Baby with Smokey Robinson. I almost died. But he's the most wonderful, loving, giving, supportive person. He's just a lovely, lovely man. You'd like him. He's smart, too.
I'm so glad I asked.
He had this wife, Claudette, you know, it was all over. It's like,
but how many others that made you, like, stop the clock and let's listen, let's...
Oh, there were many. I mean,
Hank Williams, for sure. Right?
Well, Hank Williams. And the first time I ever heard Frank Sinatra's album, Only the Lonely, I was just mesmerized. I heard it the same night. I had this boyfriend in Tucson, Alan Fudge, who turned out to be an actor. And he brought home one night, he brought home the first Bob Dylan record and Only the Lonely that he'd bought in the store, you know, Frank Sinatra. And we were taught, you know, like we were hippies and stuff. And we were taught, well, you know, these old-fashioned, old fogey singers that sang standards. It was just elevator music, and we were supposed to ignore it. And I thought, this is really good, you know. That culture said this is jive and that only Bob Dylan is valid. And I said, these guys are both great storytellers. They're both great singers. Bob Dylan is an amazingly good singer. And Frank Sinatra is a true bel canto singer in the true bel canto tradition that they have taught, you know, that they don't teach so much in opera, but that they did for centuries. So I love them both, and I refuse to give over one to the other.
Explain the Dylan sound. I don't hear the great singer.
He's a great singer. I was listening to him in the car today.
Explain
it.
He's
a great phraser. He's amazingly in tune. He has a great way of pronouncing lyrics. You should hear the live version of The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. It's a live recording. It's just fantastic. The way he pronounces the words, the way he serves up the meaning to you with his pronunciation and his will. And he's, while singing, it doesn't matter, you know. It's always in tune. His rhythmic sense is just incredible. He's a great singer. Take my word.
Speak of the girl singer. Speak of some of the girl singers. It always comes to mind that Benny Carter, the alto player, said Dinah Washington was the best.
She was an amazingly good singer, and you can sure hear her in Amy Winehouse. I mean, Amy Winehouse just copying her for all she's worth while she was singing with Tony Bennett, you know, just really copying her, doing it brilliantly. I loved Amy Winehouse's singing. She made me cry. Her singing was so good. Valerie, I love that. But, you know, we lost her. She was the one that got away.
You've got to speak about Emmylou Harris. And again, what was it that you, I mean, you loved working with her, but what was it you found in her voice, in her...
Well, Emmy's voice... When Emmy sings, you're riveted. You have to pay attention because Emmy is like reaching out and grabbing you by the shirt and saying, you have just got to listen to the story because if you don't, somebody's sure to die. You know, I mean, it's desperation. She's making this last desperate plea for her life. And it's a prayer. It's the most prayerful sounding thing I've ever heard. You know, that I always say, I don't know, Emmy... When I heard her sing, I was on the Neil Young tour with Neil Young, and I'd heard that Graham Parsons had a new girl singer that he was singing with, and he was doing a duet with her. And it turned out they were playing at some club in Houston, and Neil and I were playing at some Coliseum there. So we decided to go down after the show to hear him sing. And I walked in, and it was like this really rowdy place. It was a biker club, and they were like, you know how people are in Houston. They're so refined. So I go, they make a lot of noise. And I went, oh my God, this is going to be tough. So Emmy started singing, and the place just went quiet as a pin. I mean, quiet as a pin, and went quiet. She was singing away, and I was mesmerized. I was just riveted to the spot. It was like the whole room fell away, and it was just Emmy singing. And then I went, she's singing country rock. That's what I do. And she's a little better at it than I am. Uh-oh. And I thought, okay, I can feel really bad, and I can feel diminished, and I can feel jealous. Or I can just surrender to loving Emmylou, and I can just join all the rest of the slobbering, drooling fans that are standing in that room. And I can maybe, I can get to sing with her if I do that. So I just surrendered to the impulse, and it was the best decision I ever made in my life. And it has colored every decision I've made subsequently. I've never been particularly jealous. I'm not a very competitive person. But I was good and threatened by her, and I decided I better just emotionally get myself really in a strong, true place about it. And I did, and we wound up singing together, and it was one of the best experiences, that musical friendship with Emmy, who's, by the way, one of the best Girl Scouts you'll ever meet. She's built to last, and long may she run. She's just a great girl, and she's one of the purest musicians I've ever met. Mm. And Emmy was one that was also chasing art song, and she didn't care what was popular. She wasn't going to chase something just because it was trendy and because she thought she was getting it on the radio. She was going to sing it because it told her story in the particular way she wanted to tell it. So she and I felt like we're like wandering through the enchanted forest, holding hands like Hansel and Gretel, you know, in the magical musical forest. And if it weren't for Emmy, I would have gotten lost. I never would have found my way back. But she opened doors for me that I couldn't open by myself.
What did she teach you about singing?
Well, she taught me to just go for the throat of the note, you know, just don't worry about anything else except just gotta tell that story and tell it in the truest way you can. Mm. And when I'd sing with her, you know, I just get into that really prayerful place, and you're just, you know, when you're singing, you don't have any body, you don't have any new dress that you just bought to think and make it look cute on stage. It's just that sound and that story, you know, and that's what it was with her.
Linda, you must tell us a Dolly Parton story.
Well, let's see. What Dolly did with us in the trio was, she comes from the Appalachian Mountains, and she's a wonderful singer, by the way, and it's like old English, her mannerisms, and a lot of her, the words that she uses and the way she speaks English are like, I don't know, old English. It's frozen in those mountains, and she has this beautiful voice that's like, it's effervescent, you know, it's like water, clean water splashing over stones is sort of what I think about. But she gave the trio a real sound of authenticity. She sings a lot of embellishments and a lot of ribbon bow ties. You know, there are a lot of things going on. She sings. Dolly likes everything to be kind of frilly and have a lot of ribbons, including her singing, but it's very effective when she sings. And Emmy, you know, is doing that prayerful thing. And I was kind of like the lecithin in the candy bar. I kind of glued everything together and made it kind of emulsify. And my voice is a little heavier, and it just kind of solidified everything, because both of those girls are kind of bubbles, effervescent bubbles going all over the place, and I just kind of led along, you know, kind of kept it. So that's, and it worked really well. We could also duet, like Emmy and I could duet, Dolly and I could duet, Emmy and Dolly could duet. We saw it sounded good, and then we did the three voices, you know, I mean, our voices sounded good. We don't know why we liked it, but we did.
How much of that was improvised?
Well, the girls are both natural harmony singers, and I'm a good natural harmony singer, so we'd make up our harmonies, but if the harmonies got too complicated, I was the one that usually sorted them out. I'm pretty good at that. Emmy's really good at, you know, providing that incredible prayerful soulfulness, and Dolly's really good at doing that authenticity, and I was good at sorting out the parts.
Could we digress a moment? Did you see the movie 20 Feet from Stardom?
I did. I sang with a lot
Wasn't
of those
it amazing?
I cried. It just was a fabulous. Go see that movie. It's so good to make you feel good.
I saw it three times, and I just loved it.
And that kind of singing can only happen from Black Church. You know, that was the zenith of that kind of singing.
Yeah.
It comes from Black Church.
It's a revelation, you know, for me this summer, comparable to your book. I mean, the inner life of girl singers, most of them, and amazing women, and in a sexist, oppressive, male star-driven world, they found health and happiness, and like you, they've lived to mature womanhood, and they've taken their hits, but they've come back. I love the woman who had been a Raylette who was leading a church, but also, I mean, there's something deeply, deeply human that's revealed there, as well as these incredible voices like Lisa Fisher.
Oh, what a singer.
I mean, no, she's in the
Sarah Vaughan. And Tata Vega? Holy cow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Mary Clayton?
Oh, I sang with her a lot. She was fabulous.
You did.
And not only was she a great singer, but when she was singing with you, she gave you so much support that you just felt like $1 million. You know, you felt like you were the best singer. It was really Mary.
What about Darlene Love?
You know, I was a huge Darlene Love fan. I never got to sing with her, but all of us, you know, who were trying to sing rock and roll, we all wanted to be Darlene Love. She was the hottest thing there was. She was so innocent and sweet in her real, you know, she was a hot, hot chick. But it was, compared to now, you know, like Miley Cyrus, it's like we were all like the Virgin Mary. And there was something so sweet and innocent about her. And Ronnie Spector, she was the other one. She was the other.
I made lists of singers that I wanted to get your views on.
Okay.
It sounds silly, but I didn't Google anything. I was just thinking of the singers that I love, and I wanted to test you on them. But then before we're done, I want you to sort of, I'd love a Letterman list of the 10 perfect songs. perfect songs
oh my God.
And perfect singers. But just what I think of it. I mean, first the Femmes. You've spoken of Rosemary Clooney. I mean, I remember one come on to my house when it was new, and I always think of her backstage on the last Carson show with Johnny Carson. Supposedly, she said to Joe Williams of the Basie Band, she said, "You know what's important about this night, Joe?" He said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You and I will never be on television again." That was a comment on the Carson show more than music, perhaps. But tell us about Rosemary Clooney, on whom it turns out Nelson Riddle had a deep, long, more than crush, really.
She was fabulous. Rosemary Clooney has been described as the best friend a singer ever had. And she was also once described as singing like she was gossiping over the backyard fence, which I thought was the most apt thing. And I called her, I would say that if there was such a thing as a Girl Singers Anonymous, that Rosemary would be my sponsor. But Rosemary was the great love of Nelson Riddle's life. And we were opening my show that I did with him at Radio City Music Hall. We opened it in a really small place to start with, right? Out of town so that nobody noticed. We didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know if anybody was going to show up. We didn't know if they were going to throw rotten tomatoes. And Nelson had been away from the zenith of the business for a while. And I had never worked with somebody like Nelson or put on a show with an orchestra. I didn't know whether people were going to show up and start hollering for Blue Bayou or Heat Wave or whatever, you know. So we were standing in the wings and we're holding hands because we were so scared. My knees were knocking together. And he said, he pulled up his sleeve and he said, "Look at this." He said, "See these?" He said, these cufflinks are cufflinks that Rosemary Clooney gave to me. He said, "I always wear them for luck." He said, "Don't let me down tonight, baby." So I went out there and I was so scared. It was a psychedelic experience. I was just beside myself. I was like out of my body looking at this idiot girl singing there trying to sing "I've Got a Crush on You." And we got through the show somehow, and then we wound up, that was very successful. We wound up making 3 records together. And then Rosemary, after Nelson died, Rosemary wrote me a letter and invited me to sing at this benefit she put on every year. Mm-hmm. And I wrote her back a handwritten note saying, "I'm dying to meet you. I would love to talk to you about Nelson, because he always spoke so highly of you." And she wrote back immediately, "Come to dinner," you know. So she lived not too far from me. Mm. And that was the first time I met her. Jerry Brown, for some reason, had come by that night. We weren't still dating particularly, but we were good pals. And he'd always come around if he got hungry. And it was like, "What's for, you know, got anything to eat?" So I said, "Well, I'm on my way out to dinner at Rosemary Clooney." She said, "Well, can I come along?" I said, "Well, I don't know. It's a dinner party. I'll have to call her." So I said, "Can I bring this Jerry guy along?" She said, "Fine, bring him. She's a Democrat." And so, good Irish Democrat. So, and there was this huge bouquet of roses that someone had sent me lying on the entry table. And he said, "Oh, we need to take her some flowers." He said, "Well, just take her these." I said, "Those are mine. It says right here to Linda, you know." "Oh, we're not gonna." He's very tight with the dollar, Jerry Brown. He never said. I don't know why the Republicans ever worry about him, because he will not part with a red cent. You know, they should always elect him, because he'll act just like a Republican. Once he gets in office, he won't spend any money. So, especially on the things I want him to spend money on. So, at any rate, so he felt a little guilty. So he said, "Well, they're hers now. You know, I'm just gonna take out the card, and then they'll belong to her." So we got there to her house, and we were giggling about that, and she came out. She saw us laughing our heads off. She said, "Come in here, you two." So we sat down. She made us a spaghetti dinner. And at some point during, we were making Catholic jokes. We were talking about having all of us grown up Catholic, you know, and the nuns and the priests and this and that. Jerry was an altar boy. And at some point, Rosemary turned around to me, and she pointed her finger at me. She said, "I want to tell you something." She said, "You're going to be in my life for the rest of it." And I was. She's a great person.
Speak of boy singers. Everybody, including me, loves Johnny Hartman, and especially that Coltrane.
He did Lush Life, Johnny Hartman.
Yes, he did. You've heard the story, and I think it's true, that Sinatra tried to sing Lush Life, the Billy Strayhorn.
Yeah, Nelson told me this story. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's in Will Friedwald's book, and how Sinatra couldn't get it. And Nelson said, "No, let's put it away for a while."
Well, there's a mistake, and even in the Johnny Hartman version, "Life is lonely again, da-da-da-da-da." There's a half step difference in when that passage repeats. And I think he was struggling with that. He said, "Oh, this song's too damn hard to sing anyway, just forget about it." And there was some amazing, you know, arrangement that Nelson Riddle had written for him that he just then had to put on the shelf. God only knows what, and he never was able to find the original version. I said, you can arrange that for me because I'm dying to sing it. So he wrote me an arrangement for it that was just exquisite. And I remember we tried it out. We were in Tokyo playing over there. And I said, pass the charts out. Let's, you know, let's put it on stage. And I hadn't recorded it yet. And it was the first time I ever heard that chart. And it just knocked me down. It's a beautiful chart that he wrote for me.
Mm.
And I didn't sing it very well on the record. I learned how to sing it better later. It was a work in progress. It was difficult, but there were certain things. Once you learn, it was like working on the jungle gym, you know, or the monkey bars. Once you learn where to pull yourself up, you know, it's a really beautiful, it has a lot of facility for a vocalist.
I hate to say we're running out of time, but I just want, how many songs could we agree on that are, that sort of prove your point about the incredible gift of the American popular song to the universe? I mean, which ones would you send to Mars as an example of,
well,
what we can do down here?
Someone to Watch Over Me, that's a really great one. Little Girl Blue is one of my favorite ones. Lush Life, of course, I just, my favorite of them all, I think. I loved What's New. It's just like, it's...
What's New has to be on the list.
In its simplicity, it's like haiku. It's just as elegant as a Japanese poem. It's just beautiful, beautiful, stripped down to the bare essentials song. A lot of them.
Every day of our lives growing up as kids, my mother sang... she called it, Would God I Were the Tender Apple Blossom, but it's the music is the Londonderry Air.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes called the Londonderry Air, but it's the...
which is Danny Boy, right?
The Danny Boy lyric. Yeah. I mean, the Danny Boy melody.
It's the most beautiful melody ever.
I would have to put that on the list. Can't claim it for the United States, but...
I was thinking of... that's not an American standard song, though. It's an Irish song. Londonderry...
Snuck that in you. Sarah Vaughan singing Embraceable You.
Oh, God, beautiful, beautiful.
We haven't spoken enough about Sarah Vaughan.
Well, I love Sarah Vaughan. I also love Ella Fitzgerald. What I like about Ella Fitzgerald is that the composer put a lot of thought and energy into the way that he was going to sing the melody, and Ella Fitzgerald always at least established that first, then she'd riff on it. Sarah Vaughan never even bothered with the melody. She'd just make up her own. But it was pretty good. It was a good melody. She's a great singer.
How about Marlon Brando singing I'll Know When My Love Comes Along? And that's on YouTube, too.
I don't know that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I didn't know Marlon Brando sang. I thought he was an actor.
He did. I think just to show Sinatra.
Oh. When was he singing with Sinatra? What were they doing?
I
don't know. Oh, I didn't... okay. I don't know, you know.
Go to YouTube
I never saw that.
And look up Brando...
I don't have
I'll
a TV. For 30
along.
Years, I had no TV, so I don't know from this stuff, but I'll check it out.
What other songs for all time prove the point? Betty Carter. Well, I would say you have to have Frank Lesser there.
Frank Lesser, Never Will I Marry. I sang that. That's a bitch to sing, but I love that song, Frank Lesser. Never Will I Marry. Never Will I Marry.
What about the Betty Carter, Ray Charles version of Baby, It's Cold
Outside? One of my favorite of all time, ever. My whole life I wanted to, I tried to get Joe Papp to do a duet of that with me one time for fun, you know, because I thought he'd pick up on it. It's such a subtle little interaction, you know. Their relationship is just revealed in each little line, each subsequent line, you get another idea about what's going on between them.
How about Al Hibbler singing Do Nothing to Hear From Me?
I love that too, it's good.
You nominate a few, and I'll...
Play me your iPod. You can play me your iPod. You're playing me your
Let's
iPod.
Hear yours.
I love Famous Blue Raincoat by Jennifer Warnes. I like so many things. I love Estrella Morente singing En Lo Alto del Cerro de Palomares. I love Lola Beltran singing Paloma Negra. You know, I love the Trio Calavera singing almost anything. I don't know. It's just, one is overwhelmed by the sheer enormity of stuff. I'm pretty bad at that.
Marvin Gaye, what's going on?
Oh, my God. I kissed Marvin Gaye one time. I have to confess. He's such a... I forgot all about it, too, until just this very minute. We were on the Motown 21 show when I wasn't flirting with Smokey Robinson. I was kissing Marvin Gaye in the wings. And because he sang Trouble Man, and it was so good. It was one of the best things I've ever heard. He was a vocalist extraordinaire. He was that link between pop music and jazz and R&B, and he stood in all the corners, and he could just outdo anybody in any of those genres. He was a great, great singer.
And we have no doubt today saying that that's an art song.
And he was a good kisser.
I mean, time to...
I'm thinking in 1966, I mean, that we were all alive in 1966, the Pulitzer Committee at Columbia University overruled the nomination of Duke Ellington for a Pulitzer Prize because we don't, that's not what we mean by serious music.
Oh my God, Duke Ellington was the most serious as they all, of them all. He was as serious as the grave.
Yeah.
He was serious.
Linda Ronstadt, they're giving us the hook. It's okay. Such a pleasure to yammer. We could do this all night.
My pleasure and time. I'm giving you my email. You have to send me those links.
I will. Every one of them. Thank you.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Linda Ronstadt. Her memoir is titled Simple Dreams. All of Linda Ronstadt's opinions on songs and singers, mine too, of course, beg for second guessing and third opinions. So leave your reactions and your favorite songs and singers on our favorite website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.